Welcome to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later, where we research the response of our past and review their relevance for today. This is your host, Moshe Kurtz. All right, welcome back everyone to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. If you are listening to this essentially more or less in real time, then you're probably coming back from your Pesach Bein Hazmanim or vacation. So welcome back, and we are back to our regular, God willing, weekly schedule. And we are going to be kicking it off, as I said, with doing certain tshuvos that push the genre of response to literature. And we're going to be kicking it off with Rambam's Igeres Teiman, known in English as the Epistle to Yemen. You know, once we start talking about epistles, it makes me think about Christianity. And I guess I'm not too far off, because contained within this tshuva, he's going to address Christianity, he's going to address Islam, as well as many other fascinating things that our guest today, Rabbi Chesky Glad, is going to be presenting on. So, Rabbi Chesky Glad is a senior Ram and the director of the Accelerated Shana Bet program at Yeshiva Torah Traga, as well as a co-founder and the CTO of a high-tech data startup called Roga Analytics. And me, a Yeshiva Bacher, doesn't even know what CTO is, but it sounds very chashuv. He earned his smicha from REITs and holds a variety of degrees and certifications in the realm of data and artificial intelligence. Rabbi Glatt has lived with his wife and children in Yerushalayim for the past 8 years, and it is a pleasure to have you with us here today, and I'm really excited. So I think this is, ironically, the first time we're spending our focus on a tshuva of the Rambam, though for those who see the video, I have over here the Machon Yerushalayim Tshuvos HaRambam, a two-volume set, and his epistle or tshuva to Yemen, to Teiman, is not even in there. In fact, I think it's in a separate volume of Kisvei Rambam. So maybe before we jump in, and it's a long, you know, it's more of a Megillah, or we call it Megillah Nigeres. So it really is quite a Megillah. It's not something you easily stick in an envelope and mail to your buddy. This is an open letter we're going to be looking at in just a moment. So maybe, Rabbi Glatt, you could give us a little bit of the historical context. Tell us a little bit about the letters of the Rambam in general, and what's unique about this one, and how it differs from, you know, what you might think of as a typical tshuva of the Rambam.
Sure. So first of all, Rabbi Kurtz, the pleasure is really all mine. I've listened to a number of these different podcasts and have always been impressed, and it's really an honor to now get to be one of your venerable guests. And I'll turn directly now to the question that you raised, which, as you said in your introduction, this really does push the limits of responsa literature. Because what happened here was that it started off as a standard tshuva. You have a rabbinic figure, a leading member of the community in Yemen, reaching out to, not so close by, but another leading member of another Jewish community in Egypt, reaching out to the Rambam, asking for guidance, advice, a few specific halakhic questions, but really the type of thing where you turn to a mentor, somebody who you trust their understanding of how people work, for their savvy, for help and guidance in a particularly stressful situation, as we'll turn to in a moment. And the Rambam didn't just reply in a standard tshuva format with an analysis of the halakha, giving the background from the sources and downward. The Rambam chose to then turn this into that epistle, into that igeres that we're familiar with, by going at length into a description of the broader meta issues involved in the specific halakhic questions. And not only that, but he intended it to be understood and read by a massive audience. In essence, then, the Rambam took this otherwise ordinary shaila and turned it into a stage for him to then go and write this epistle. So it's interesting that it takes the form of a tshuva, because he does address the points that Rabbeinu Yaakov, the sender, had raised, but then he transforms it into a stage for him, again, to make the polemical arguments that he intends.
Fascinating. So that seems to be the distinction. When editors, you know, the manuscripts don't arrive as, here are the tshuvos and here are the Kisvei Rambam. You have scholars who are poring over it, and they kind of classify it this way. So the tshuvos tend to be more halachic, and not to say
although you will find, like in many of the Rishonim, you'll find the small tshuvas, the kind of right off the cuff, clear cut answers in the Rambam's Tshuvos as well. And I'll also make note of another work where you also have gathered Tshuvos of the Rambam's called the Peir HaDor, which that one is a little bit harder to find, but you can also get it in your local bookstores. But for example, I tried looking, it wasn't on the version, at least, of Bar Ilan that I had, so I couldn't provide you those sources. But there are many different Tshuvos of the Rambam which are extant nowadays. Not as many as some of the other Rishonim who we might be more familiar with, like the Rashba or others, but the Rambam does have many Tshuvos which survived, which speaks to the fact that he, in his day, played the same role that, going back to the Gaonim and then into the era of the Rishonim, of receiving letters from across the world from people who recognize his leading stature as not just a posek, but a community leader, and turned to him for guidance on all levels.
Right. And what's really unique, I think, about what we're about to look at is there are many tshuvos in the Rambam that obviously knowing the historical context always helps, but it's not essential. Like one of the famous tshuvos, or let's say famous, one of the iconic tshuvos of the Rambam is about people talking during Chazaras HaShatz and his ruling to community. So I can glean from there, I don't need to know the historical context to know that people talk during Chazaras HaShatz. I think
always have, always will.
It's played Klal Yisrael, right, since the beginning of time or whenever it was instituted, and right, probably Adi Mosa Mashiach, or right, maybe even then also, who knows. Right. But here, I think it's very important if we just take a moment, if you could give us what is the historical backdrop of this letter that prompts it, and what exactly is like the Shaila, if you will.
Exactly. It's a great point. Here, the historical context is absolutely crucial to understanding what the Rambam was aiming to do here in this tshuva. And I'll give you a little bit of background on the Rambam himself first, because by focusing on a few events in his life, it helps make some of the points that we'll discuss here even more salient. So the Rambam was born in Cordova, in what we know nowadays as Spain, in the late 1130s. And then about 10 to 15 years later, he was forced out by the Almohads, the invasion of radical Muslims who insisted that the Jews either convert or flee or die.
You know, where have I heard that one before?
Right. Unfortunately, the Rambam was born into the end of a specific golden era in Spain. It would come back, but this was one of the big eras where Klal Yisrael was relatively safe in that area of the world, but this was the conclusion of that. The Rambam then spent the next 10 years or so wandering around the Mediterranean with his family, his father, Rabbi Maimon, Dayan, and his younger brother is also famous, I guess, Rabbeinu David, you know, as he would be. He's known for the tragic incident in which he lost his life in travels, and the Rambam ended up having to deal with his widow and his orphan child as well. So the three of them and the rest of the family went and wandered around the Mediterranean, including during a significant amount of those years, a few years, some say even up to 5 years, he was in Fez in Morocco, where the Rambam had been taken specifically by his father because his father knew of a particular Talmud Chacham, Rosh Hashiva, if you will, who lived in that region, whose name was, Rabbeinu Yehuda ibn Susan, he's referred to. And he was somebody who had a real ability to teach on an extremely high level, and the Rambam's father recognized the potential, and his son wanted him to continue learning despite all the travails they had experienced. And they settled in Morocco for a few years, where the Rambam learned under Rabbeinu Yehuda, until, unfortunately, those same Almohads came and insisted everyone convert to Islam. And it doesn't seem like they gave a choice to the leading Talmud Chacham of the day in that region, in Fez, Rabbeinu Yehuda. And he, unfortunately, was martyred. And the Rambam, therefore, had to flee a second time from radical Muslims who insisted upon conversion or death or, again, exile. And then that really helps paint the backdrop of the tshuva we'll discuss. I'll mention that it was likely during his stay in Fez when the Rambam wrote that other famous Igeres regarding similar topics, the Igeres HaShemad, or the Maamar al Kiddush Hashem, as it's sometimes referred to, where the Rambam discusses at length when it is permissible and when it is prohibited for somebody to convert under duress. So the Rambam then on his way to eventually settling in Egypt, he stops by Eretz Yisrael. He has a remarkable story about how he went to the Makom HaMikdash even, and he davened there, he found it very significant. And eventually he settled in Festat, which think I'm pronouncing it right. I'm no expert on the Rambam. I'm just a lover of the Rambam. And it's what we know as Old Cairo. And there he achieved prominence. Eventually he becomes the Nagid, the community leader. And also, interestingly, this is after his brother David's death, tragically at an early age, that the Rambam then goes and uses his knowledge of medicine to become the personal physician to Saladin, the founder of the, I hope I'm saying this right, also I think it's Ayyubid dynasty, and Saladin is famous for his role in fighting off the Crusaders around Jerusalem. And
yeah, like movies about this.
Yes,
I don't know if Rambam ever makes an appearance, though. There should be a. Was it Rabbi Beryl Wine? He made like these animated movies. There was a Rashi animated movie. There's a Rambam one. These are things from my childhood. I need to dig up.
I'm not sure. There are legends about the Rambam having a relationship with Saladin. I don't know how documented that is historically. Now, you'd expect that they have interaction. He was the court physician. He worked with all of his family. But I don't know how much, you know, they sat there, you know, in armchairs debating whether this religion or that religion was correct.
It wasn't like the Kuzari backtrack story.
Yes. Yes. I'm not sure how much evidence we have to support that type of notion. So let's turn to the specific tshuva now. I think that that's important to realize the Rambam had experienced this in his own life very, very viscerally. So the background to the tshuva is that another Rabbeinu Yaakov, not to be confused with Ibn Susan, who we mentioned before, but this one we don't know really much about. His father's a bit famous. Rabbeinu Nathanael Al-Fayumi from the Yemenite community were the leading rabbinic leaders in the community at the time. And they reached out to the Rambam, not Rabbeinu Nathanael. The Rambam knew Rabbeinu Nathanael and knew of Rabbeinu Yaakov, his son, as well. And he mentions in the tshuva how he's disappointed to hear that Rabbeinu Nathanael had passed away. He looked up to him. He was in awe of him. And Rabbeinu Yaakov had reached out to the Rambam because there were several pressing issues facing the Yemenite Jewish community. So just to give a little bit of background, this was a time when another radical Muslim movement, a Shiite movement by somebody referred to as Ibn Mahdi, began in 1150 and was continued by his son. It was threatening the survival of Jews in Yemen, essentially forcing conversions to Islam in the same way. And then the Rambam in this tshuva is really dealing with a community which is stricken from two different angles. One, the one we just mentioned about forced conversion, and in almost an opposite direction where people were considering, doubting their connection to Yiddishkeit. But those who took this as a sign of messianic portending that in essence, this was a sign, a harbinger of good things to come because things were so terrible. And as often is the case, when things go really, really bad, then a messianic figure will arrive. And indeed, that happened here. Now, this person was somebody who, in the Rambam's description, was a madman by all that he knew of him. It was somebody who claimed that he was the Messiah. And there were Jews who were circling around him. And he was, interestingly, kind of in between, though, because he was also serving as a missionary of sorts for Islam, but claiming that the Torah was in line with this now. So how do you deal with something like this? Rabbeinu Yaakov was terribly confused. The people all around him were terribly confused. And to add a little bit of more complication, there were all of the astrologers who he gave a lot of sway to, who were telling him that, yes, this was predicted, this is bound to happen, the Jews are going to eventually convert. And he just felt so helpless that he felt that this was beyond him. He had to turn to somebody bigger and wiser. And that's why he reached out to the Rambam. So if you want to ask, what exactly is the tshuva addressing? It's really addressing a number of different claims. It's what's going on here? Why do we have all this crazy anti-Semitism? We didn't start up with them. We didn't do anything wrong. It's not like they caught us in some sort of scandal. They're just attacking us. And are we really the chosen people anyhow? It doesn't look like it. In the environment in which we live, we're experiencing the travails of Galus for so long at this point. Maybe there is something to this. We think of it as a Christian claim of supersessionism. But it's the same idea of what the Muslims were saying, that the Jews have been replaced by the real chosen people. And maybe Muhammad's prophethood should be taken seriously. How seriously do you take an individual who claims that he's the Mashiach? And can you predict the date of the Mashiach's arrival through astrology? Is astrology valid at all.
It's like what you see on those like from WhatsApp statuses. You know, someone's like, oh, you know, Rabbi so-and-so from Bnei Brak in Israel said Mashiach is coming in 1 week and we all have to do X mitzvah. You ever see those?
Yes, unfortunately, I do. And that's one of the major points the Rambam talks about in the Tshuva. Towards the end, he addresses, is that something which is even permissible in the first place? Not only a bad idea, but maybe it's even forbidden by Chazal. Interestingly, the Ramban, in contrast, has a slightly different view on that, also addressing it in a work he has called the Sefer HaGeula, where, as you might have guessed by its title, he talks about similar topics of how do you assess when Mashiach is coming? How do you assess if this person's a real Messiah or not? And the Rambam and the Ramban both have similar sentiments on one level about the impropriety of trying to predict when it will be, in which year, or what time Mashiach is going to come, but their reasons are a little bit different. Anyhow, I think this is the background that is necessary. Ben Yaakov Al Fayumi from the Yemenite community reaches out to the Rambam, begging for help, and the Rambam provides a lot of help here. It's not just a simple halachic answer. He really gives him everything.
Right. So what he's going to be trying to do is a mix of two things. One is that there are actual, and this is often what happens when you have people who are leaving the faith, there could be intellectual claims and there's also emotional travail as well. And yes, Rambam is going to try to come with a two double-pronged approach to address both the intellectual concerns about Mashiach, about other religions, but also it sounds like he's going to be giving what we call divrei chizik. He's going to want to give words of encouragement. And I know we can't really go through all the language here, and honestly, it reads like piyutim. And I know Ashkenazim tend to be more famous for piyutim overall, but certainly Sephardim were very crafty themselves. Right. It reads like a piyut, and he really lays it on thick when he's praising the Yemenites. And I can understand why Yemenite Jews now swear by the Rambam and paskin by the Rambam as opposed to the Shulchan Aruch. I'm pretty sure this letter is probably proof positive. That's exhibit A of why they do that. Yes. But anyway, yeah, let's get to, want to break it down for us. What are the salient points in this Igaris?
Sure. I'll just mention, just because this is a whole podcast on Shut, that you mentioned the Shulchan Aruch and the fact that the Yemenites follow the Rambam. So the Shulchan Aruch himself has a tshuva in Afkar Rochel, where Rabbi Yosef Cairo was asked, should we allow people to paskin holy like the Rambam rather than off of your work, the Shulchan Aruch? So this was addressed by Rabbi Yosef Cairo himself. And he said, of course, it's the Rambam. If somebody has a Masorah, as these communities do, to follow after the Rambam, and they want to follow him on everything, by all means, they should. And they, therefore, the Yemenites have the Shulchan Aruch saying they don't have to pass like the Shulchan Aruch. So,
even his own words. So, yeah. And now we know why they could essentially cook on Shabbos. No, I'm kidding. They could reheat liquids on Shabbos. Chas v'shalom. Yeah. They don't cook on Shabbos.
Yeah. But I once spent a Shabbos in a hospital, and a Yemenite fellow came up to me, and he made me sit there with him for like 2 hours as he recited, I kid you not, chapter and verse of Hilchos Shabbos of the Rambam. Really, that's what he just did. He just sat there and he went through the whole thing with me. It's like 30 brachim, and I was like blown away by how truly they hold this dear.
Hey, look, if I was a community rabbi and Rambam wrote this holy Geras to me, I'd probably be reevaluating who I paskin like also. But anyway, I took a look at this already and you've read through this very carefully. Why don't you share with our listeners what's in this letter that makes it so unique and outstanding?
Sure. Okay, so to begin with, the Rambam, as you said, really waxes poetic about the Yemenite community. I assume that part of it is true and part of it was just, you know, formality and being nice. But it does seem like there was a booming, significant Jewish community, at least from what the Rambam describes, in Yemen at the time. And there's clearly deep mutual respect from that which they said about him, the Rambam. Interestingly, almost out of character, shyly bats it away, you know, in a very humble fashion, like, you're only saying that because we have a close personal relationship. I was embarrassed by it. You know, he knocks it aside. And then, of course, because of his great love for this community, he turns to his horror upon hearing about the terrible persecutions they're facing, the Shmad on one hand, the false messianic claims on the other, mixed with this strange leaning towards Islam, and he's really troubled to hear about the community's suffering. And what the Rambam does then is launch into a remarkably moving and inspiring drusha about some of the most essential issues. What is the source of anti-Semitism? It's, in his words, jealousy. That they, both the Christians and the Muslims, see us as the true religion, and they know that their claims and the Torah are false and baseless, and therefore they've persecuted us just to try to stamp us out. In fact, the Rambam discusses in general the history of anti-Semitism. You know, when we speak of the word anti-Semitism nowadays, it certainly rings very loudly. And the Rambam says, in his understanding, there were originally two different types of those people that sought to stamp out Yahadus from the world. There were those who did so by the sword, and those that did so, I wouldn't say quite by the pen, but through their word. Those who tried to just kill us, and his examples include Amalek all the way down to the Roman Empire.
It's
and
the Purim versus Hanukkah dichotomy, right? Our spirits versus our bodies.
Exactly. So you have that different type of way of addressing the Jewish problem, if you will, and coming up with their unique solution. So the Greeks, as you just alluded to, being on the other end of that spectrum. But now, the Rambam says, a third group has popped up in the past couple of hundred years with the birth of Christianity and then later Islam, where you have people who aren't just trying to attack Klal Yisrael and our mission by killing us or claiming that we are totally unbased and illogical, irrational, but rather now they're encountering something new, and that is a claim of replacement, where the Christians claim that they are us, and the Muslims claim that they are us. And in that case, the Rambam says, there is no comparison. And he launches then into a polemic of how, to those who know, there is no comparison whatsoever. It might seem, oh, they're a monotheistic religion and they're a monotheistic religion. They have their laws and they have their laws. The Rambam says it's like comparing a statue in his parable to a living, breathing human being. That the features are kind of the same on the most superficial level. It's made from bronze, though, and it has no innards. It doesn't have a brain inside. It doesn't have breath inside. And this is a real breathing head with eyes and a nose and everything. It's not comparable. And it's his jab at those who might have been confused by their study of comparative religion. And he says, you don't understand anything. You have to trust me on this. Those that know, know. And there's no comparison whatsoever between our religion and their religion. We have the true faith. And they're just jealous. And in
right.
fact,
he says, like, you know, they have rules, we have rules. And, like, you know, it has the veneer of Judaism. It has some of, you know, to someone who's just an onlooker passing by, they see a statue. You know, many times you'll pass a store and you need to look closely to discern if it's a mannequin or a real person, if it's made very accurately.
Right.
So, you know, but these are just a mannequin. And this reminds me of course, going ahead many centuries later to R' Moshe Feinstein in one of his many tshuvos about non-Orthodox movements. I think it's the one on Maris Ayin. He also has a lot of tshuvos in Maris Ayin, but it's the one about conservative Judaism. And R' Moshe Feinstein articulates, I don't have the lashon in front of me, but he says many people erroneously think that they're just different flavors of Judaism.
Right.
But it's not different flavors. They're fundamentally different ideologies.
Right.
And so Rambam seems to be making a very similar argument many years beforehand, distinguishing Judaism from Christianity, which broke off from Judaism, and Islam, well, not exactly a breakoff, but is competing as well.
Right. And their claims, he says, come from our Torah itself, and they're desperate. They try to say, but Ma'od is a reference to Muhammad, and Rambam's just scratching his head. This is obviously nonsense. Anybody who understands how to read the Torah, even slightly beyond the most superficial levels, understands how their arguments are hollow, are just totally hollow, and there's nothing there. And what the Rambam then does, which is so interesting, is that he takes one of the deepest parts of our Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaalpeh and explains them as if they were the simplest, easiest to understand things, instead of just going for the ones like I just mentioned, where obviously they're just butchering the text. But he even chooses prophecies which are very, very opaque, and he dives right into them and brings to light how much they clearly, obviously, are demonstrating the truth of Judaism, which is just, I think, his way of showing how confident he is. He says, we can go the whole spectrum here. You know, any text, anything you want, demonstrates the proof that we are right. And he does so, at least in my opinion, in a very convincing way. He manages to speak of the loftiest ideas, but in such a relatable, easy to understand language, which I think is crucial to appreciate in this particular tshuva. And I wanted to address that point as well. That the Rambam's intended audience wasn't just for those that might have even known these psukim in the first place, might have struggled over these issues in the first place. He was concerned, clearly, about the community. He was concerned that people, though he says, only a fool, only somebody who has no understanding would fall for these proofs, but he realizes that these polemics are being used against his people again and again and again, and there are a lot of people who are ignorant and a lot of who don't know how to respond and don't know how to see things deeper than that superficial level, and he wants to make sure that they not be swayed by these type of arguments. So he, at the end, clearly states his desire for this epistle to be taught widely across all different demographics, to women, to children, to everyone, and which is also, by the way, likely why he chose to write this in the vernacular, in the Judeo-Arabic that they had, so that way there would be broader accessibility for this epistle. And his style and content in general are just meant to be engaging, and that's what we said before. It's like a drusha, where he just goes off onto all these crucial points about what's the source of anti-Semitism, and what is the defense of the Jewish faith, and it's basic tenets, which he turns to then afterwards, some of the things that we might be familiar with, maybe from his more halakhic works of the Perush HaMishnah, and then certainly from the Mishnah Torah, where he describes how you can tell when a Navi is a real Navi versus a false Navi, and he invokes so many points of powerful, polemical value that it's clear that he's trying to persuade a broader audience here, rather than simply to, in a very logical and orderly fashion, present his case.
Right. And of course, we don't have enough time to go through this entire lengthy text. I think you told me there was a book published that actually translated all of it into English.
Yes.
Perhaps we can link that in the show notes for those who are interested. So the Kitzer, in short, what is ultimately his refutation of these false messiahs, calculating the Mashiach, those who are the attrition, either out of Judaism simply or to other religions? How, in a nutshell, does he rebuff all these issues? And what I'd love to get to after that is just, on the show, I have to be better about this, I always like to talk about what's the relevance of the tshuva for today, and I'd love to get to that as well.
Right, because I definitely think that nowadays, at least personally, I've never encountered somebody who's claimed to be the Messiah in any sort of convincing fashion, and I don't know anybody who really has been swayed, at least in the community that I grew up in or the circles that I walk. So you're right, on some level, it would seem that his arguments, which towards the first point you raised, of laying down the law of who's a legitimate Navi and who is not, and arguing for, interestingly, he uses the proof of how Chazal Yisrael experienced all of Mamet Har Sinai together as one massive people in one revelation. And it's like having one witness telling it over to another witness. They both know what they saw. They both understood exactly what happened. And they understood that this was something which was real, as opposed to everything else afterwards can just be miracles, can be sleight of hand. And you never know exactly what's going on. He repeats many of the things that he addresses here in the Mishnah Torah, which is published at a later date in a more halachic fashion. So he makes those type of arguments, but also towards the end, and this is what I alluded to before, slightly different than the Ramban, is that he goes against the notion that you should start predicting when Mashiach will come. And that's largely because it's just a bad idea, but it's also because, as we hinted to already, it's forbidden. In the Ramban's eyes, it's something which should be never done because of the fact that Chazal forbade it. They knew that it would end so badly that therefore they said, you can't. And he has sources to back that as well. He has to deal with the awkward issue that Rav Sajagon had done so. And the Rambam, interestingly also, does not take any jabs at Rav Sajagon, which shows his reverence towards him. And also, I think, his recognition that he's talking to a popular audience, because the Rambam was not afraid to disagree with those who he thought erred, even if they were the greatest lights of Bar Mitzvah. But he says that Rav Sajagon shouldn't be castigated for that which he had done by essentially calculating the end based off of a different psukim, because of the fact that he felt that it was necessary for the people. which, by the way, was his own way to then share a secret Masora that he has. And he essentially does the same thing to himself, despite the fact that he says it's a bad idea, and despite the fact that he says that it might be forbidden to make a prediction about when Mashiach will arrive. The Rambam quotes Masora from his father, which apparently stretches all the way back to the earliest days of the Spanish Jewish community, which, based off of the way he describes it, sounds like he thinks it even came from the time of the Chorban. And that was that, based off of a pasuk in Bilam's prophecy about Ke'es, that amount of time that had been prior to Bilam giving that prophecy, which, if I remember correctly, I think that was the year 2485, because it was the 38th year of Klal Yisrael's journey through the wilderness in the Midbar. So then that same amount of time later, which came out to, I hope I'm also remembering the year correct, I think it was like the year 1210, maybe, in our modern count. And that amount of time later would be when prophecy would return to Klal Yisrael. And then the Rambam says, and of course we all know that prophecy is indicative of the coming of Mashiach. And he doesn't therefore give quite a prediction, but he gets really awfully close, which, to contrast to the Ramban really believes there's an in-force prohibition. The Ramban, interestingly, in the Sefer Geula I mentioned beforehand, does not think that the prohibition is really enforced any longer because it was limited to a specific time and a specific place given certain circumstances. And I'll send you the lines from the Ramban later. But the Rambam thinks that, no, it still remains in force, but Rav Sadia Gaon had to do it because the people needed it so badly. So it was almost like a harasha, but then it's still back in force. And the Rambam, a little bit, maybe in the back of his mind, the same purpose of Rav Sadia, trying to give the people an encouragement without allowing any of the bad idea part of it, which is that, well, if it doesn't come true, then they're gonna be abysmally depressed. So to have that happen, he doesn't give it the same type of prediction. So
that's, and I think that's really what is perhaps the most important part of this letter, perhaps, is that obviously the content in here from the Rambam is all gold. There's no question about that. But it's the fact that someone of the stature of the Rambam spent the time to write this letter and he cared enough for these people in the community, I think ultimately that's what lifted their spirits. It's something I find a lot in the rabbinate. Right. Some will turn with a shaila, and sometimes it's less about the technicalities of the shaila, but more that they wanted to see that you actually spend time trying to understand and try to care for their scenario. But
that is spoken like a true rabbi. So
there you go. I can't help it. It's made an impression on me.
I wanted to address the relevance nowadays, though. So I'll give you two quick takeaways. So number one is exactly what you just said about how the Rambam, sometimes we have this image of him being an ivory tower scholar, and it's a little bit his fault when you read the Mor Nebuchim, where he speaks of how he'd prefer to deal with the one person of understanding who has serious questions than the 10,000 ignoramuses who might disagree with him. And you get the sense from certain writings of the Rambam where he's a bit of an elitist, and he certainly was an intellectual and valued the intellectual life. But at the same time, we cannot forget how the Rambam was a community leader, a person who was deeply passionate about the Hamonah, about each and every Jew. And you get that from a different letter of his, one which I relate to as I'm a busy Rebbe and father and working and everything, where he's just so exhausted and harried all the time because he's just trying to help so many different people in so many different ways. And that famous letter to Ibn Taban, that here you see that up close and personal. The Rambam took the time to say, instead of leaving you having to deal with this issue on your own and maybe giving a little bit of guidance, a little bit of halakhic answer, I'm going to give you the answer. Take this letter and spread it. Now, Rabbi Kurtz, I want you to appreciate what the Rambam was doing. He was surrounded by Muslims. He was in their high court, in the Sultan of Egypt. And yet the Rambam wrote a scathing polemic calling Muhammad a madman. Nowadays people are afraid to call Muhammad a madman. And the Rambam did that, even though he was telling them to spread this, to scream it out, to read it in the streets, as he concludes, to make sure that it's disseminated.
He's putting his life on the line.
Exactly. Not only did he give the guidance and answers, not only did he give a tool which they can use, he was putting his own position in serious danger. And as we said in the beginning, he knew this could have dramatic ramifications. Baruch Hashem, it didn't seem to impact the Rambam that way, but it easily could have. And that's one takeaway about the Rambam not just being an ivory tower scholar, but being a real man of the community. And there's so much more to back that, but I want to turn to a second takeaway message, one which relates to us specifically in the time that we're living through right now, about how to deal with anti-Semitism. And the Rambam's clear message through and through and through and through is pride, that you should be proud to be a Jew, that it might seem that we are hated and despised by the masses, by whole cultures who we can't quite understand why. We scratch our head and we say, we're such good citizens. We're so nice to you. We have nothing against you. Why do you hate us? Why do you? He says, it's simply because they realize that we have something that they don't. We have a earnest, true connection to the Ribono Shel Olam. We have a moral compass, which is anchored in something ancient and real. And they recognize this covenant between the Ribono Shel Olam and Klal Yisrael is eternal and genuine. And they hate us for it. It might come from so many different angles, but that is the root cause. And for us, in an age of raging anti-Semitism, most during my whole lifetime, certainly, is right now, during these past few months, these weeks in specific even, it's an important recognition that we all have to have, that we shouldn't be scared or ashamed to be Jews. We should be proud. We should recognize that we have something remarkable. Nothing else in the world is quite like it. And we have to hold on to it proudly, disseminating the same message of the Rambam to the people around us nowadays too, to hold our heads high and feel blessed that we have this connection that we do with Ribono Shel Olam.
Absolutely. Very well articulated. We can understand why, A, the Rambam was the Rambam, not just because of his scholarship, but because how he used it, how he was Moser Nefesh. And Rabbi Glad, you're absolutely right that his words were not just for the people of Yemen during one time in Jewish history, but unfortunately in a post-October 7th world, his words are very relevant now, but God willing should give us that uplifting inspiration that we should be able to combat the anti-Semitism. And, you know, very important thing. It's we don't practice a religion of anti-Semitism. The best way to fight anti-Semitism is to practice Judaism. And this was a true kiyum, a true fulfillment of that. So Rabbi Glad, Hashem should enable you to continue being matzliach, both in your teaching of Torah and in your impressive work in technology and business as well. And God willing, looking forward to learning Torah once again in the future. Bezras Hashem.
Bezras Hashem. Thank you so much. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate us, subscribe, and leave a review. If you'd like to submit a letter to the editor, sponsor an episode, or just have a general inquiry, please email me at mitchellmkurtz@gmail.com. This is Moshe Kurtz, and I look forward to learning with you next time on Shoot First, Ask Questions Later.